into our fourth of the four. We're delighted to have Johnny Lynn with us from the University of Washington, who will help us to think about determining the context of excellent creation care and the need for a center for environmental stewardship and dialogue. Johnny?
Thanks so much, Peter. So as Peter said, I'm over at the University of Washington. They have a small campus called the Bothell Campus, which is over on the sort of to the northeast of the city. A little bit about my own background. I teach in a computer science department, but my formal training is as an atmospheric scientist, so I'm a climate dynamicist by training. And before that, I had done work as a hydrologist who was involved in environmental engineering. So there is some connection with the environment here in terms of what I've done in the past. It's not just a CS guy saying all sorts of random crazy stuff. Okay, so imagine the following scenario. You're at a town hall meeting on land and water use policy for the city, and everyone seems to be talking past each other. I know this seems very strange that this would ever happen, but let's just use our imagination. Some of the speakers want to leave the decisions to scientists, while others are suspicious of scientists. Some talk about the land and water in reverential tones, while others talk about land and water as commodities. So how do we figure out good environmental stewardship given such a range of views? And how can we enable dialogue to identify shared values and understandings? Now, a little context for this particular talk. This talk is sort of the concluding talk of a whole series of talks that started in 2009. And I've been thinking about the topic of what is it that makes enables us to determine the content of good environmental stewardship. So not what are the motivations for it, not our what are some of the principles that we can use, but how do we get from all those foundational ideas to the actual policies we implement, whether they be personal or whether they be governmental. And in that kind of quest, and so over the variety, over those years, I've given a couple talks here at this conference. It eventually turned into a book called The Nature of Environmental Stewardship that came out last year by Pipwick Publications, and I'll give a shameless commercial at the end for that, okay? But I want to give some sort of this context just so you know that I'm kind of launching at the very end of that entire enterprise. I'll give a summary of the things that I talk about more within the book, and that which was addressed earlier years ago. But I can summarize that summary that I will give by the first point in our preview for today, which is that good environmental stewardship requires synthesizing many fields of knowledge. And we'll add some more meat into that. The part that I want to focus on after giving that summary about this synthesis task is to ask, can we say something about what it means to synthesize all those various fields of knowledge? And here, what I'm going to talk about is, I'll talk about the goals of synthesis, of such a synthesis, these various forms of knowledge, you'll see I call determinants of good environmental stewardship. I'll talk about some presuppositions that can prevent a good synthesis, and we'll try to outline some fruitful alternative approaches to synthesis. I'll say from the very beginning that at the end of the book, I realized that the task of synthesizing all these various areas of knowledge was way beyond me, and that somebody much smarter and better than I will have to take up that particular task. But hopefully, in the book that I wrote, that I was able to sort of lay out a framework of what the constraints are of each of these various different types of knowledge, types of determinants for good environmental stewardship, and what they offer and their weaknesses to the question. Finally, I'll end with an assertion that there's a need for a Center for Environmental Stewardship and Dialogue, and hopefully that will fall out of this discussion of this complex process of synthesis. So here's the summary of of basically the previous talks. So my argument is that if you want to figure out what the content of good environmental stewardship is, you have to ask these three questions. There are these three criteria for evaluation, or three criteria for considered obedience to the creation care command. First, you have to understand what is the importance of that particular command. What There are a lot of commands God gives. There are a lot of things that we all wish could happen or wish would be true. How does the importance of this particular command to steward the earth, how does that relate to the other things that we have responsibility for? Secondly, we need to look at the goals of the command. What is it that we're trying to accomplish? Are we looking to have an environment where there is absolutely no trace of any kind of human involvement whatsoever? Or are we looking for an environment that has certain other characteristics? Well, what exactly are we shooting for in the practices that we're going to implement? And thirdly, what are the practices of good creation care, the kinds of things that we can actually do? Jim Peterson last year came up and gave me, I thought, a restatement of these three criteria as being priority, purpose, and practice. And I wish I had thought of that, but I thought it was a very nice way of summarizing it in a much more memorable way. These three criteria are determined by these particular areas, and the areas are, first of all, worldview. Worldview, in this case, is literally when you look at the world, what do you see? Do you see matter in motion, mere material? Do you see something that is holy and sacred? Do you see something that's been created by a God that is outside of creation yet is immanent and loves his creation, and so on and so forth? Second determinant, ethical theories, and I'll talk about examples of these more a little in just a second. But with regards to ethical theories, the two questions there are what has value, or how do we know what has value, and how do we weigh things that have values together? How do we weigh different values together? And there are a variety of theories to answer those two particular questions. Ray did a really nice job in laying out a spectrum of anthropocentrism with regards versus ecocentrism on that first question of what has value. Science epistemology, that's a question of, well, when we say science knows something, what are we really saying? And here, too, there's a whole spectrum and range of positions about what we mean when we say science knows something. Science policy connections, the whole field of science policy research has done some really fascinating work in trying to tease out different models for how do you take science and connect it to policy. And contrary to conventional wisdom, there are actually here too a very large range. Some models work better in certain circumstances and other models work better in other circumstances. Politics is about how we organize our common life, organize power and interrelationships, and economics is about how we organize our common life with regards to material, with regards to money and resources, etc. Into these determinants, there are variety sources, reason, revelation both with regards to what God tells us, as well as revelation that comes through the work of authorities that are human authorities, intuition, etc. There's just a whole variety of inputs there. Okay. So some examples then of the determinants of the criteria for evaluation. In terms of worldviews, I outlined a couple of them. How do you see nature? Is it matter and motion, etc.? Monism would understand would be an Eastern conception that sees existence as all there is. There is no differentiation existentially between a human being and a rock and a chair and a tree. In terms of ethical theories, I'm not going to talk much about this first one because Ray did a nice job in his talk. But with regards to various ways of weighing different values, there's the sort of traditional three within the study of ethics would be deontology, virtue ethics, and consequentialism. Last speaker talked about virtue ethics in the context of Bill Mason, and so I won't talk much about that. Deontology is essentially looking at what duties or rights do we have, can we identify, and saying, okay, the way we weigh different values is if we can identify duties and rights, those take preeminence and those trump. With regards to consequentialism, the way we weigh different values is to look at their consequences, look at what their results are. Intentions, duties, rights, those don't really matter. Science epistemology, hypothesis testing is probably the one that we're most familiar with, so I won't talk much about that. Popperian falsification would understand that knowledge really in science comes not from proving something is true, but only from proving something not being false many, many times. And so they're the only kind of knowledge that you have is a negative form. There's no such a thing as positive knowledge from science. On the other hand, the Kuhnian paradigm shift would understand science in different terms. It's much more socially constructed. It's much more related to the rules that people follow, the scientists follow in terms of constructing knowledge. There are different things with regards to then what the standards of proof are or what status of knowledge is under these contexts. Science policy paradigms or ways of connecting the two. Under the policy perspective, prescriptive paradigm, you understand policy as being directly dictated by whatever the science says. Under a fact-value dualism paradigm, you see science is merely providing facts that politicians and philosophers, etc., take and apply values to and then decide on policies, and there are other paradigms that are used there too. Politics, individual versus social action, is societal action is one of the big questions, and in economics, market versus governmental solutions. Okay, so now we've done this kind of quick examination of the determinants of the criteria for considered obedience to the creation care command, we need to talk about synthesize. And here by synthesize, I mean there's this huge list of things. There's a huge list of possible answers to each of those questions. Different worldviews, different ethical theories, different ways of understanding science epistemology, of science policy studies, politics, and economics. How do we synthesize a coherent understanding or way of processing to understand what would be a good environmental stewardship? So first I want to talk about the goals in such a synthesis. I would suggest that first that the we have this wide range of determinants. Well, we need to make sure that that there's a logical consistency in the conclusions of each one of these particular determinants. So for instance, if you make a worldview conclusion that contradicts with a conclusion from an ethical theory model that you choose, well, that's probably something you want to avoid. We assume that synthesis is a messy task, so if there are paradoxes, that's not something that's that unexpected. But if we have maximal level of logical inconsistency between the various different determinants, then that's probably problematic. Secondly, these determinants in the synthesis, they should be properly weighted. Oftentimes, we only look at one or two determinants and focus on that. In Christian circles, I think a lot of our discussion is on what the Bible says and on what science says, and those are the only two things that really are discussed when there's a whole variety of things that also need to enter the mix in that particular conversation. A third goal of synthesis is that we need to have guardrails to prevent destructive logical extremes. Ray talked about the misanthropy, or basically hatred of human beings, that comes from one of those particular logical extremes. So are there ways in the synthesis to provide some sort of protection from going off the deep end? And then I would say fourth, that the synthesis needs to provide guidance on both well-known and lesser-known issues. So it should provide guidance on large-scale controversial things like climate change, but also on small scales, relatively benign things, maybe at the level of a more local issue. Okay. So with those particular goals, I would say that those provide some sort of a brief outline of what sort of a positive description of what a synthesis should result in. Here I want to talk about some presuppositions that would unwillingly block, and that's why the fence here with the penguin, right? It's like I'm looking for a photo that will show blocking, and it's kind of interesting. Okay, so there's some presuppositions we can bring to the question of synthesis, of how to synthesize these various different determinants. And here I say presuppositions, not bias, because the word bias tends to have negative connotations. All a presupposition is a way we have of understanding these determinants, and we assume them uncritically. We don't ask ourselves, you know, whether or not this is something that's justified or go through the process of justifying. And the reason this is something I think we need to be aware of when we're trying to create a synthesis of all these determinants is because these presuppositions can affect how we process the meaning of the determinants and impede our synthesis if we aren't aware of them, because we'll make certain decisions about, okay, this is the content of creation care, but we didn't realize that we made that jump with all these presuppositions that we're not actually aware of. So here's one example of a predisposition, would be what I'm calling the sin model, and that is, so when you have, when sin happens, or we're thinking about, we're doing something sinful, nobody, or in, at least nobody who is doing what they're supposed to do as a brother or sister in Christ, no one comes to you and says, keep on sinning a little bit, and maybe stop 5%, and then maybe later stop 10%, right? If somebody's committing a sin, you say, please don't sin. You're supposed to remove whatever it is that's usually what your own decisions, whatever it is that is resulting in that. That particular model of understanding solutions or responses to problems or issues, if applied into other contexts, would suggest that if we're going to solve problems, we need to focus on removing the causes of those problems. And in many cases, we should focus on removing the causes of the problems. But if some cause results in some outcome, there are actually more ways of dealing with that cause-response connection than merely removing the cause of the problem. In the case of climate change, of global warming, we can see sort of a range in this when we look at mitigation solutions, adaptation solutions, as well as geoengineering solutions, some of which are mitigation, other ways are more adaptation. The point here is there's a range of possible solutions. Whether or not we decide one versus another is appropriate, we need to like call out what are the assumptions we're using for making that decision. Some kinds of predispositions, three that I want to just point out are worldview, ethical theory predispositions, and a third one, a processing disposition, that is how predisposition, how is it that we actually are working to integrate things. Here's a list of a few of them. I'm not going to talk about all of these, but instead I'll just make a comment about two. This one, the first one, the is-ought fallacy and the biological disciplinary perspective predisposition. In the first one, there's oftentimes a predisposition where we'll have that if we know what something is, then we'll automatically be able to convert that into an ought, into what we should do. Within the field of philosophy, that's known as the is-ought fallacy. And I'm not going to go into detail about that, but I'm just saying that oftentimes we have that assumption or predisposition in our mind, and so when we find something as an is, we automatically go to, okay, well, this is what we need to do, without actually asking the hard question of, well, what ought we do? The biological disciplinary perspective predisposition is essentially a lot of the discussion, and one which should not be surprised by this, since the modern environmental movement really came out of biology, but the language and discussion is all within biological terms. And those terms, limits, sustainability, ecosystem, compatibility, those terms are useful, but they have connotations because of their biological context that often we're not aware of. And so here I'm just saying if we are able to bring that to the fore, then we're able to synthesize better. Okay, so the last part I want to end with is just to say that there are alternative approaches to synthesis, and the focus in these is that we consider a multiplicity of solutions as well as utilize multiple understandings of environmental value and recognize multiple forms of knowledge. And I would suggest that taking that route towards trying to synthesize all these various determinants would be more productive. The need for a Center for Environmental Stewardship and Dialogue, basically, I would assert that most of the work that's being done in this field is done by organizations that are either advocacy-oriented or focused on one or two determinants, which is great. But there also needs to be a place where there can be a neutral meeting ground for dialogue and provide an incubator for synthesizing a very broad range of views that might not be welcome in venues where there's more focus to the work that's being done. So with that, here's my commercial. If you want to hear more about this, the book is Nation of Environmental Stewardship, and the URL, the webpage there, there's a sample chapter if you're interested in seeing whether or not it's worth your money, and I'll take any questions. Keith,
So, as you're going through that, it seemed that to me is that that's a very kind of very useful way of thinking through my own positions on a particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
That I have, you have to sort through each one of those steps for yourself and try to come up mm-hmm. with something that is consistent. And a useful way of resolving the question for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? So, it seems like you have to
right.
start there with each individual. Now you bring, so each individual has to do that first.
Mm-hmm.
And then they come together in a group, and now you have a whole bunch of different people that arrived at different conclusions.
Right.
How do you get
right.
now what you
do? Right. That's a really great question. So the question was, is what do you do when you have people who have a variety of different outcomes or conclusions based upon the analysis that they've done? I think one of the things the taxonomy, at least I'm hoping, is helpful for is it can point out, first of all, so once you've gone through this process, you're able to sort of you're able to say, okay, I believe this is true for these particular reasons, and I believe this is true for these particular reasons. Out of that, you should be able to also identify which are beliefs that are essentially beliefs of principle versus beliefs that are essentially beliefs of prudence, for lack of a better word. Another way to put it is, what are some things that I am willing to compromise with, or a place that I'm willing to sort of find a meeting ground? What are some things that I just cannot go down that route? And one of the hopes that I would have is that if folks from a variety of different positions on this on the issue of creation care are able to delineate for themselves exactly why they believe certain things out of the spectrum of each determinant, and then are able to identify which ones are essentially philosophical differences that there's it's a deontological imperative, a categorical imperative, it's a right, a duty. I'm not going to listen to you, versus something like, hey, this is a place that I'm willing to have I can compromise with, and then to have conversation there about that. The other thing I would say, too, is one of the neat things out of the science policy literature is there are frameworks precisely to work with stakeholders who have differing views and priorities. I forgot the dude's name, Daniel Kemmes, over at the Rocky Mountain West Institute or something like that, associated with either Montana State or University of Montana, talks about something that a process called collaboration that's used over land use disputes, discussions, issues over in the Rocky Mountain West, as you'd expect. And the interesting thing about that process, without going into detail, is it very specifically works to try and take out this adversarial science aspect of a lot of public policy decisions dealing with land management and dealing with environmental issues, where one side hires its scientists, the other side hires its scientists, and bam, bam, bam. And the main thing about the way collaboration works is it starts with lived knowledge of the stakeholders who are in the area of interest from all sides. And starting with that, then there's this whole other process that goes through that works towards greater policy stability than the kind of adversarial thing that we're more familiar with. So I think that there are also these models that promise the ability to work out and compromise much better than the ones that we're familiar with in most of the new stuff.
Other questions? Go ahead.
Could you describe in a little bit more detail,
That's a great question. I realized when I wrote the abstract and then I wrote my slides, there was only one slide on this. And I realized, well, this is all I have to say. And so I guess, you know, to a certain extent, it's kind of inspired by the ASA. The ASA, you know, as Leslie was talking about last night at the banquet, wanting to be a big tent organization to really welcome folks on a wide range of positions with regards to the issues dealing with faith and science. I would hope that a center like this, and it doesn't have to be co-located, it could be, you know, dispersed people from various places, would be a place where people feel like that they're respected, even though they have a position that maybe in public, there would be a group of people that would really condemn them. And that in that context, you would be able to have, really clear dialogue about, okay, you make this assumption, that leads you here. I make this assumption, that leads me here. Where can we work, where can we work, go on from this? Maybe one of the aspects that I would say, and this is kind of related to something I didn't really talk about, is this last part, realizing people and relationships matter. I think that a lot of the discussion on environmental issues, because it seems so urgent, whether or not it, from one perspective, one is feeling the urgency is dealing with whether or not the environment is taken care of, or urgency from folks who feel like, well, this will result in all this irreparable harm to human systems, to economies, etc. The dialogue gets so heated that I think the relationships that really underpin and undergird the ability to have compromise get short shrift. I would hope that a center would be of the kind I'm describing would also be a place where that kind of thing could really occur.
In communications theory, when there's mm-hmm. disagreement or miscommunication, mm-hmm. the tendency is to see the other one as either mad or bad, mm-hmm. as evil or crazy.
Yeah.
And the framework that you put here helps us to defuse that polarization, I think.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.